gathered in London on Sunday for the 24th International Islamic Unity Conference. The annual event, held at the Islamic Centre of England, aims to promote religious unity, combat sectarianism, and defend Islamic values.
This event coincides with a similar Islamic Unity Conference held annually inside Iran. The Islamic Republic has come under a sustained attack in recent weeks by Western groups advocating for regime change following the unfortunate death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini.
Many groups are involved in backing the anti-Iran riots, most notably Western-based Iranian dissidents and supporters of the MKO terrorist group. Although they are divided on doctrine, one factor unites them: Islamophobia.
They are hijacking maybe an agenda to portray this clash of civilization, and they are portraying this narrow-minded, neoconservative narrative that Muslims are barbaric, Muslims are narrow-minded, and Muslims need to be liberated. And this was the type of language that was used at the dawn of the second and the first Gulf Wars, of trying to say, we're here to liberate Muslims, we're here to liberate their countries, and this is very dangerous.
These are actual people who have an agenda to make Muslims and Islam enemy number one across the world. So whether it's targeting the Islamic government and the Velayat-e Faqih system in Iran, or whether it's attacking a woman with hijab on the streets of East London, actually the phenomena is rooted in the same thing. It's an actual organised attack on Muslims.
The anti-Iran riots have expanded to include an international campaign condemning Islam and Islamic concepts, such as the hijab. It's now up to Muslim leadership to find ways of combating the tide of anti-Muslim abuse. Initiatives such as this intend to inspire a fight back. Robert Carter, London.
On Saturday, anti-government rallies and protests were held in the Italian capital. In the morning, high school students took to the streets of Rome to stage a protest that converged on the education ministry. Pupils were demanding more investment in education after what they call two decades of budget cuts and the country recording the highest school dropout levels in the EU. They sent out a warning to the next government, saying Italian schools must be upgraded to be of quality standards.
We are still wondering why the government hasn't scrapped a 2015 school reform. We demand the next executive to put an end to obligatory work placements in the last 3 years of school and to declare a state of emergency for Italy's school buildings.
Later on Saturday, hundreds of people held a demonstration not far from the government building. The initiative was organized by a recently formed anti-system movement called Sovereign and Popular Italy. At the demonstration, people urged the next executive to do more to shield families and companies from surging energy prices and to stop sending weapons to Ukraine and find ways to promote peace internationally.
We want to stress how the lies told by the mainstream media on the conflict in Ukraine have brainwashed the Italian people. It's NATO who declared war on Russia using Ukraine as a tool. An end must be put on this historical phase made of imperialistic violence and the longing for expansion.
Our movement demands the next government to pay in full for people's exorbitant bills and to review the country's foreign policy that is literally plunging our economy into chaos. But I am afraid the next executive will stick to the same line adopted by the outgoing Draghi government.
Italy is in the process to install a new government as the Mario Draghi government collapsed in July, leading to snap elections. The far-right formation Brothers of Italy has emerged as the party garnering the most support from Italians in the vote last month, and its leader Giorgia Meloni is slated to become Italy's next prime minister. More protests were held in Italy over the past days. Earlier this week, operations were suspended for 24 hours at Genoa Airport following a demonstration called by the Ansaldo Energy plant's employees against plans to close the factory. Also, the Italy's largest union, CGL, staged a large demonstration in Rome about a week ago, demanding more protection for workers. a hot autumn of protests and strikes seemed to have just started in the country. Max Civili, Rome.
In what's being called a disaster for the ruling Democratic Party, inflation has reached a 40-year high in the final official reading before next month's midterm legislative elections. The data is even worse than it appears because the government excludes food and petrol from the official inflation rate. The record high is being driven by increases in other necessities such as lodging, medical care, and mass transportation.
You know, at this point everything's expensive, but we have to buy what we have to buy. So at this point we're going to pay for everything. It's not very fun, but we do it.
No one likes the higher prices, including myself, so we're just trying to get through it until we can make enough money to be able to afford everything.
With prices rising 8.2% and wages increasing just 4.9%, economists say the average American effectively lost almost an entire day's pay last month, and that's using the official inflation rate. Even though almost every economic indicator is negative, the nation's bankers seem intent on restricting borrowing just when businesses are pulling back new job offers in record numbers and credit card debt is at a record high. The situation has already deteriorated into liberalism's theoretically unsolvable dilemma, stagflation, which is recession plus inflation. The right-wing economic policies may also produce political stagnation. The likely Republican takeover of the House of Representatives and possibly the Senate would hobble President Joe Biden's ability to get any major legislation passed for the next 2 years. The nation's bankers are trying to stop price increases by destroying the demand for goods and services. The reduced demand should lower prices eventually, but the policy rules out wage increases for workers and keeps corporate profits high. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has held a big protest in the Gaza Strip to condemn the surge of Israeli attacks in Al-Quds and on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. People thronged the streets of the blockaded territory following the Friday prayer to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. In recent days, extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds and asserted that armed resistance is the key to reaching freedom.
We condemn the Zionists' provocations in Al-Aqsa Mosque, and we salute the freedom fighters in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Today, we're entering a new era where armed resistance against Zionist occupiers is the strategic choice, not only in Gaza, but also in the occupied West Bank, Al-Quds, and everywhere in Palestine.
Protesters also expressed their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli aggression and attacks. Palestinians in Gaza have expressed their willingness to sacrifice their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds. Occupied by Israeli forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for justice and freedom.
Al-Quds is the core of our struggle against the Zionist enemy, and we are willing to die in order to protect it. Zionist forces and settlers are skirting Al-Aqsa, and we must escalate the resistance against the Zionist occupiers.
This is while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Palestinians here are calling for stepping up all forms of resistance against Israeli plots over Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Less than 4 weeks before the United States midterm legislative elections, the committee investigating the election-related protests on January 6, 2021, announced that they will subpoena ex-President Donald Trump to testify. However, most analysts believe Trump will not ultimately testify, and his written response to the panel was noncommittal. Trump has reportedly been telling aides he favors testifying as long as it would be done in a live public hearing, but the commission isn't likely to agree to that.
Almost 2 years after the presidential election, the country appears to be as divided as ever, with Trump supporters calling the subpoena an October surprise meant to influence the midterms, while anti-Trump partisans say the subpoena proves that not even an ex-president is above the law. The January 6th committee has been alternatively branded as a necessary defense of American-style democracy or as a staged show trial. What appears certain, however, is that it has had seemingly no effect on the American public. In poll numbers, which are virtually unchanged despite nearly 2 years of intense mainstream media focus on the committee, 35% of America still calls the events of January 6th a legitimate protest, while 50% of the country still calls it an insurrection. Over 60% of Republicans still believe the 2020 election was illegitimate. In 2017, polls showed that over 60% of Democrats still believed the 2016 election was illegitimate. America's political division did not begin on January 6, 2021, and it does not appear that the committee will fully unite the nation by voting day on November 8th. The news of the subpoena was announced on what many say was likely the commission's last public hearing. The final report is expected shortly after the elections. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The battered town of Obeznoy. I came here to find out if locals are fearful of the Ukrainian army, who have made recent gains not far to the west. A local school in the center of town.
Yes, we are worried. If the Ukrainian army comes here, there will be reprisal against teachers. But our strength is in the hope that it will never happen. I have colleagues whose children happen to be on the other side. They are afraid of coming to work because they are scared for their children and themselves.
Why do you think Ukraine would kill teachers? What's the reasoning behind that?
They say that we are ideological frontline workers and we are involved in Russian propaganda. This is the main thing that teachers are blamed for, but this region is 80% Russian speakers.
Irina, who's lived in this town all her life, tells me that she has heard rumors that teachers have been killed in Kapiansk, a town recently taken by Ukraine. This shocking video was posted online, claiming to be civilians in Kapiansk. It was uploaded by Maxim Zorin, a former member of Ukraine's notorious Azov Regiment, although he later altered his post, claiming the video had been taken from a Russian soldier's phone.
Now, to my knowledge, this is the only video that has surfaced in this war so far that clearly shows civilians being executed and dumped into a mass grave. Now, this video has been completely ignored by the mainstream media of NATO countries. Why? Because the evidence suggests a strong likelihood that these are Ukrainian soldiers executing pro-Russian civilians.
A headline from Britain's Daily Mail newspaper. The article quotes an advisor to Ukraine's Interior Ministry. A hunt has been declared on collaborators, and their life is not protected by law. Our intelligence services are eliminating them, shooting them like pigs. A humanitarian center. The Ukrainian government have not only threatened teachers, but those who distribute or receive humanitarian aid with jail.
We did nothing bad. We tried to help children and elderly people. What did we do? We were giving out aid under shelling. We helped people who couldn't walk. What shall we be afraid of? We just helped. I think there's nothing bad in it.
One of the volunteers asks us for a lift to help an old woman nearby.
What do you think of the Ukrainians threatening people who take humanitarian aid?
We heard of it. We even saw a video that in Kupiansk, some guys were taken into trenches and shot in the head. We have no internet, no proof. But they say there are nationalistic battalions that do it. It shouldn't be so. We are all people, Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian.
While thousands of pro-Russians flee Ukrainian advances in fear, those that remain in areas taken over by Ukraine risk execution due to their political leanings. Indeed, most in Donbass expect a genocide or ethnic cleansing of Russian speakers if the Ukrainians were to ever reconquer the region. Johnny Miller, Obeznoy, Donbass.
In order to verify the names of inmates on both sides, a Saudi technical delegation arrived in Sana'a, while another from the Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a entered Riyadh, and the first stage of the swap deal clinched in Amman.
Sana'a always stresses the importance of humanitarian issues, and if there is a progress on humanitarian cases, it will lead to dialogue on political and military cases as well. There could be an extension of the terms and confidence building between the two parties. Sana'a welcomes any progress on humanitarian issues, encourages this visit, and asserts that its military warnings are serious, and moving toward peace is in the interest of Saudi Arabia.
The head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners Affairs says the visits have nothing to do with any political talks. However, observers say this mutual visit is the first of its kind since the beginning of the war 7 years ago. Therefore, it is an indication of direct communication between Sana'a and Riyadh.
After nearly 8 years of war, siege, and the growing Yemeni military capabilities and the resilience of Yemenis, today the world realizes that Sana'a represents the Yemeni people. This is why we see international movements and international visits to Sana'a. The visit by the Saudi delegation is not the first of its kind, but there have been unannounced visits previously, and Sana'a welcomes peace endeavors.
Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mehdi al-Mashat, held talks with Assistant Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs of the United Nations, Joyce Msuya, in Sana'a. Al-Mashat urged the world body to reject all inhumane measures taken against the Yemeni people.
Following the failure to renew the UN-brokered truce and the military parades of the Sana'a government, the international community is making new moves to find a more reliable agreement that satisfies both sides and ends the sufferings of millions of Yemenis. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
The olive harvest season has begun in the Gaza Strip, and farmers are picking olives on their land in order to provide for their families. Palestinian farmers and their families leave their everyday routines in the middle of October and dedicate some of their time to pick the fruits of nearly a year of hard work and special care. The olive harvest season runs until early November. The tiny coastal territory used to have a thriving olive industry, but it has suffered a major setback due to years of Israeli blockade and wars, as well as the systematic destruction of olive trees. The state of Gaza's olive farmers reflects the scope of human rights violations committed by the Israeli regime against thousands of Palestinian farmers. Israel's tight restrictions have been preventing farmers from acquiring badly needed equipment for irrigation and planting.
The situation is very difficult, especially for olive farmers. It takes many years to grow olive trees, and the Israeli blockade has made it extremely difficult for us to get fertilizers and badly needed farming equipment.
The annual olive harvest season is considered a key economic, social, and cultural event for Palestinians. Olive and agriculture in general have been hit hard by the Israeli blockade and war since 2007. Farmers here are struggling to keep this vital sector alive. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Liz Truss is fighting for her political survival, with MPs in her own Conservative Party threatening to oust her. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. Prime Minister Liz Truss is fighting for her political survival, with Conservative MPs threatening to oust her and even allies warning she has just days to turn around her premiership, despite ripping up her economic strategy and appointing Jeremy Hunt as the new Chancellor. The beleaguered Prime Minister will attempt to shore up her crumbling support by gathering her cabinet ministers at No. 10 Downing Street on Monday evening and then embarking on a series of meetings with mutinous Tory MPs before the next budget in a fortnight's time. After crisis talks at Chequers over their new fiscal plan on Sunday, Jeremy Hunt insisted that Liz Truss was still in charge, despite her increasingly perilous position, as he warned of further public spending cuts and failed to rule out more U-turns on her disastrous mini-budget, including scrapping the 1p cut to the income tax base rate. Ministers will wait anxiously for the markets to open, the first test of whether Liz Truss's decision to sack Kwasi Kwarteng as Chancellor and tear up her mini-budget will be enough, amid fears that the sterling could head towards parity with the US dollar and rising bond yields put upward pressure on mortgage rates. The leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, increased pressure on Liz Truss, calling on her to make an urgent House of Commons statement on Monday, with party insiders saying that they would do everything possible to force her to come. The Prime Minister says she is in charge, but the evidence this weekend suggests she is in office but not in power, he said. An opinion poll by Opinium for the Trade Union Congress, TUC, using the MRP method to estimate constituency-level results, projected a 1997-style landslide victory for Labour, with the party winning 411 seats. It suggests the Conservatives would lose 219 seats to end up with just 137 seats, with the Liberal Democrats on 39 seats and the Scottish Nationalist Party on 37, with 10 cabinet ministers, including Jeremy Hunt, Jacob Rees-Mogg and Therese Coffey, losing their seats in a general election, along with former Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Meanwhile, plotting at Westminster continued with a group of senior Conservative MPs, many of them supporters of Rishi Sunak, planning to meet on Monday night for a dinner hosted by ex-Treasury Minister Mel Stride, amid speculation that as many as 100 no-confidence letters have been submitted to Sir Graham Brady, chairman of the Backbench 1922 Committee. The veteran Tory MP Crispin Blunt was the first to go public in calling for Liz Truss to step down, saying he did not think the Prime Minister could survive the current crisis. Crispin Blunt said, "I think the game is up and it's now a question as to how the succession is managed." The former minister, who was the first MP to call for Ian Duncan-Smith to quit as party leader back in May of 2003, told Channel 4 News, "If there is such a weight of opinion in the parliamentary party that we have to have a change, then it will be affected. Exactly how it is done and exactly under what mechanism, but it will happen." Another backbencher, Jamie Wallace, who entered Parliament in 2019, broke cover and joined the call for Liz Truss to quit, confirming to The Guardian that he had submitted a letter of no confidence. "In recent weeks, I have watched as the government has undermined Britain's economic credibility and fractured our party irreparably. Enough is enough. I have written to the Prime Minister to ask her to stand down, as she no longer holds the confidence of this country," he said. Later on Sunday, Andrew Bridgen told the Daily Telegraph, "We cannot carry on like this. Our country, its people and our party deserve better." As she tries to stave off open rebellion, Liz Truss will this week continue her meetings with small groups of Tory backbenchers as she desperately tries to convince them to back her, while Jeremy Hunt will hold a series of roundtables on the economy for MPs. However, Downing Street insiders acknowledged the Prime Minister's position was extremely fragile. Her decision to bring Jeremy Hunt on board buys us some time. "The budget will look very different now, but we're taking one day at a time," one said. Another government insider suggested that it would be one hell of a gamble for Tory MPs to try to oust the Prime Minister when there was no obvious successor to take over from her. But one leading rebel said, "I don't see how Liz Truss can survive. Jeremy Hunt is a good man but her credibility is below zero. The executive of the 1922 committee will meet on Wednesday as usual, with members expected to discuss the precariousness of the Prime Minister's position. The Reuters news agency gives us more details about the same story. It was a bruising meeting with her Conservative lawmakers this week that finally shook Prime Minister Liz Truss's earlier unwavering faith that she could weather the market fallout from her radical economic growth plan. 2 days later, a chastened Liz Truss addressed her first news conference as Prime Minister to admit she had gone further and faster than markets expected, and sacked her friend and finance minister Kwasi Kwarteng to try to appease her lawmakers. Offering little in the way of apology, Liz Truss instead insisted her government could not give up on economic growth, but would slow the pace and bring on board more centrist lawmakers to quell a rebellion in her party. She also dropped another of her pledges to scrap a planned increase in corporation tax to try to calm markets, which had balked at the size of her spending plans, combined with a lack of detail about how they would be paid for. With her credibility in tatters, she is now fighting for her political survival. "I want to deliver a low-tax, high-wage, high-growth economy. It's what I was elected by my party to do. That mission remains," she told news conference in a low voice, absent of the bravado that marked her appearances in a leadership campaign. But it is clear that parts of our mini-budget went further and faster than markets were expecting. So the way we are delivering our mission right now has to change. We need to act now to reassure the markets of our fiscal discipline. It was a low-key, almost solemn performance from a politician who bounded on stage and lapped up the applause from the party faithful during the leadership campaign when she beat her rival Rishi Sunak to become Prime Minister on 6th of September. Then, buoyed by her victory, she felt she had no need to appoint anyone but her loyal supporters to a cabinet team of top ministers, irritating some lawmakers who felt she should have tried to do more to unite the party. Yet the signs were already there. She had won fewer votes than Rishi Sunak from lawmakers in earlier rounds of the leadership contest, and those who did not back her were quick to criticise her first steps in the role. When Liz Truss unveiled her economic programme on 23rd of September and the markets plunged, that criticism grew, and even those who had supported her wondered out loud why she had failed to prepare not only the markets but the country for the scale of her tax-cutting plans. She explained to lawmakers she had to act quickly to help families and businesses with skyrocketing energy bills, but few understood why her economic programme had to be launched at exactly the same time. A misstep, she later admitted. But instead of trying to bring in frustrated lawmakers, those closest to her said she pressed on with her plan in her Downing Street office, convinced the markets had overreacted and would calm down when they understood what she wanted to achieve.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This one lay.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And yet another futile and hostile move. The European Union, following the footsteps of the U.S., Canada, and the U.K., have announced new sanctions against Iranian authorities and entities in a show of support for rioters over alleged human rights violations. Does the European Union, representing countries in the 27-member bloc, have a footing to stand on when it comes to human rights? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the double standards at play and how this will impact the relationship between the EU and the Islamic Republic. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Batul Subeti joins us. She's a political analyst who joins us from London. Also joining us is Sayed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, who also joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll start first with you, Batul Subeti. We are looking at the EU to have imposed sanctions on Iran over what they have called human rights abuses, which is alleged. They have, one segment of it has been on Iranian police and security sectors who have been working so hard to try to protect people, try to protect property, etc. And this is viewed, in one sense, if you agree, as a way to undermine the country's police and security apparatus who have been standing up to the rioters. Do you agree with that? And what do you view? What's your reaction to the EU sanctions in the first place?
Right. Yeah. So, of course, as we all know, Mahsa's tragic death sparked those widespread protests. And, you know, thousands did take to different streets demanding answers and justice for Mahsa, which is something expected. It shows that the Iranian nation is energetic and won't tolerate potential injustice. But, of course, it's also no surprise that the mobilizations turned very quickly violent. You had armed separatist groups that clashed with security forces. And as you mentioned, the security forces did what any government force is expected to do in that situation. That's to clamp down on rioters, who, of course, began to pull off the headscarves of Muslim women, setting public properties on fire. So the way that the protests morphed could never in any way, shape, or form be characterized as peaceful by the slightest. It wasn't normal. And not because of the way that the security forces dealt with it, but because of the rioters. I mean, it was led by foreign trained spies. And there's a lot of evidence of this. You know, the attacks on Iranian security forces that enabled terrorists to come out. You know, one of them was the anti-Iran terrorist Kamala group. Iranian intelligence sources also released information about how groups who are affiliated with Al-Qaeda were actually killed by the Iranian military forces in provinces like Sistan and Balochistan after they claimed responsibility for deadly attacks on police stations that killed four IRGC members. You know, the IRGC even dismantled arms trafficking gangs in places like Western Azerbaijan. So, you know, it's no secret that the West had pre-planned this. You know, whether they were going to use the title of Mahsa's death or any other title, they unleashed their undercover collaborator networks to wreak havoc in order to exert pressure on Iran in this very, very sensitive period where the nuclear negotiations are ongoing. And the West does this from time to time. It hijacks Iranian people's demands. Uh-huh. And this protest was certainly not even as large as 2019's and certainly shouldn't even compare to the scope in 2009. But in terms of the second part of your question on Europe, the sanctions that they had put. We see how Europe is actually just following the traces of America. And it does this, you know, it does this against its very own interests. So even if I give the example of confronting Russia via Ukraine.
What is their interest? What is their gain here by doing this?
Right. So there is a trajectory of Europe following America when it comes to these things. I mean, I was giving the example now of even when it comes to confronting Russia via Ukraine, the European stance against Russia has actually harmed Europe. So it's not even a case of what do they gain out of it. They're actually harming their interests by following this American trajectory in a very blind fashion.
Very well. So, you know, it's interesting, say, Mohsen Abbas, what our guest there, Batul Sabeti, said, because tell us the thought process as you see it when you take a look at the EU and you have certain events, incidents that are tragic in a country, which every country experiences, such as Iran, and they pick this one out. They don't listen to what Iran has provided in terms of the cause of death, and they are disregarding in the sanctions that they've imposed some of the great examples that our guests there cited about these outside groups like the Kamala that she didn't mention, but you know, these are foreign-backed terrorist groups. All those are not mentioned. The killing of IRGC members, that's not mentioned. And yet they come out, they impose these sanctions, and they are portraying the Islamic Republic as a negative force in all of this. So give us your take on the whole thing.
Well, it's fundamentally a soft power war, which Europe is complicit in. It always has been. It's hidden behind, of course, the Anglo-Zionist empires, you know, coattails. But the reality is that it is part and parcel of that. And now even more so, if we're thinking of the Europeans of having some sort of independent foreign policy, I think you could forget it, because now that they've been cornered into literally being on the front line of a war with Russia, you're going to see even less and less of an EU neutrality, as it were. And what you're seeing here is really just a manifestation of the ongoing hypocrisy of Europe and its general kind of attitude towards Iran. There is an Iranophobia. There is an Islamophobia, which is locked in systemically to European foreign policies. It's locked in systemically to their domestic policies. And the hypocrisy becomes even more apparent about what they're doing with Iran in terms of being so judgmental. And as Batul said very rightly, that they were part of an organized, orchestrated, deep state, systematic effort to change the regime, or change the government, as they'd call it, regime. Of course, that hypocrisy is exposed by the fact that Islamophobia and the attacks on Iranian property here in Europe have been pretty much allowed. I mean, there's been very little police response or protection offered for the Islamic Center of England here in London, which was attacked. We know that people have been attacked in Hamburg. There are all sorts of clear and obvious examples of Iranian MKO operatives being given a free hand, a free rein, really, to do as they like. So you can see that the hypocrisy there is there. Of course, the other hypocrisy is that Europe has a track record of stamping down very, very hard on peaceful protesters. I mean, the Yellow Jackets, for one, an example in France, where you can go and pick any number of incidents you like where the actual really militaristic French police stamped down very hard when it was necessary for them to do so. The Banlieue riots in Paris are another example. Tens of thousands of people who were marching in Belgium's capital, for instance, and in the Netherlands, and even Austria, Croatia. We've seen during the COVID-19 response, when people did object, again, there was a huge stamping down and a massive a police state, if you like, draconian putting down of any opposition to the standard establishment government line. So it reeks of a hypocrisy. The Western and the European particular response is totally hypocritical.
Well, you were talking about, Batul Sabeti, about the these groups that are foreign-backed, that are getting their funds and inciting acts of violence and participating in it. Now, based on what we have been provided, the EU has intentionally actually disregarded and dismissed documents that were offered by Iran. And I'm guessing that that's even as an act of goodwill Iran providing these documents to prove foreign support for the riots. Why is the EU, do you think, then disregarding it if Iran is providing proof of it?
Right. This whole orchestrated campaign against Iran is in order to apply sanctions in the first place. So someone might ask, why sanctions now? The main aim of the sanctions now is to increase the instability and to provide the ammunition also for the rioters. I mean, even if that's on the level of providing internet, for example, you know, Elon Musk spoke about, you know, Starlink. You have tech firms that are relieving sanctions on access to apps like Zoom, for example. It begs the question of, oh, why now this is happening? It's to sustain the riots. Now, the sanctions are an so basically the riots are an excuse for the sanctions, but these sanctions are a means to an end. It's a means to pressure Iran to comply with American demands. They want a nuclear deal, but they still want sanctions on Iran. They want to have their cake and eat it. Specifically now, the US is looking to change its strategy of dealing with Iran. Since they haven't been successful through negotiations, Iran wants sanction relief. It wants robust guarantees. It wants verification. Nothing outside of the scope of the previous deal, since Iran has always been compliant, but it wants reassurances, and it has every right. And the US haven't been able to pressure Iran or to convince Iran to forego its demands when it comes to sanctions relief, verification sequencing. And Iran has had the upper hand in the negotiations. The nuclear bar negotiations have been on a stumble block because Iran is not in a hurry to get it signed. It wants to gain the maximum out of it. So to wreak havoc internally, to get riots on the streets, is to pressure Iran. It's to use this protest movement to ask for more sanctions in hopes of even potentially sustaining its and hastening its conclusion, or to get Iran to compromise on its rights.
Sure.
Not realizing that they're actually shooting themselves in the foot and further demonstrating their lack of goodwill and intention. The whole point over here is we will discuss the US because Europe is really just an extension of US foreign policy.
I see. Okay. Well, it's interesting that you call it a protest movement. Say, Mohsen Abbas, when you take a look at whoever is out there that is rioting and breaking the law, which includes vandalism, which includes more so, not so much vandalism, but destruction of property. We're looking at these groups that are very clear in what they're chanting and what they want. And basically, they want a change in the governance of the Islamic Republic to whomever or whatever is not clear. Given that, which is clear in their chants, the EU is still supporting that, if you want to call it a movement, or those people, or those groups. Isn't that clear interference in another country's affairs?
It absolutely is a clear interference, but when have they ever not interfered in other states who are not complying with the overall, if you like, international order, as they would say? The international order, by that, they mean their masters. The masters are the money mafias that control the banking fraternity of London, Wall Street, and beyond. So Iran remains the only real state which is not within the Bank of International Settlements, isn't complying to the world order in a full and final way, and is resisting on so many levels, on a regional level, and is resisting not only militarily, but is also capable of now resisting with cyber technology. And you notice that they have actually started sanctioning the cyber efforts or the cyber capability of Iran. This is specifically because they fear Iran's capability of not only on a military level, which it's proved time and time again on the ground, but they're also now going to fear that Iran will recognize that it needs a really powerful soft power response. You need an equally powerful way of being able to resist the propaganda, the deep state kind of psychological operations, the rollout of all of these kind of color revolution efforts. There needs to be a much stronger content and substance, which will help to educate not only the Islamic Republic of Iran and its own population, but also the world at large, because we're now living in a world where huge changes during this great reset, which Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum and others are pushing. Now, Iran is not totally part of that. And one of the examples I'll give is that Ayatollah Khamenei very wisely resisted the Agenda 2030, for instance, the UN Sustainable Goals role. Now, that's just couched language for depopulation, for LGBT agendas, for more hedonism, more liberalism, and more control of the agricultures and the industries of the so-called poorer nations. Now, Iran has very strongly resisted that, and I think that these things all make sure that Iran is enemy number one. So Iranophobia is not an accident. It's something that's whipped up, whether it's Netanyahu when he was showing his little childish graphs about why they should bomb Iran's nuclear plants, or whether it's Donald Trump trying to assassinate a diplomatic mission with Haji Qasem Soleimani. All of these actions are basically a desperation. They're desperation of the money mafia. They're desperation of Israel, which is their favorite pet in the world, and specifically in West Asia. And the Europeans are basically a paper tiger that wags. It's a tail. It wags every time the Atlantic, if you like, real powers, the Americans and the Zionists that control them, actually tell them to jump. Look, for instance, German exports to the U.S. are worth $110 billion per month. That's one quote I've had in 2017. I mean, it sold $3 billion to Iran at that time. So you can see there was a no-brainer in terms of Europe going the way of the Americans and doing as they're told. And now that the Russians are squeezing the energy aspect of it and of their lifeline, you can see that all of these nations will fall even more in line with the Americans. And they're not going to let up in terms of trying to see a JCPOA or a nuclear agreement which really works in the long run. And Iran has already started shifting his attention very rapidly to China, Russia, and the Eurasian axis with the Shanghai Cooperation, etc., and very rightly so.
Yeah, we only have 5 minutes left, so many angles to cover over here. I got to squeeze this one in between what both have said. It's kind of not along those lines, but again, it gives another dimension to this. And I'd like to ask you, Batel Sobeti, about how the EU has insisted that Iran has been involved in the Ukraine conflict by sending military equipment to Russia. Now, this has come despite frequent denials, again, in relation to the sanctions that have been leveled against Iran by the EU. Now, the quick question that comes about is, why would they do that when they themselves have provided countries like France, the UK, and Germany, for example, have provided weapons to Saudi Arabia when it comes to the war on Yemen, which has killed so many innocent civilians?
Right, exactly. So the whole, I guess, this whole war that is being launched is really just one of consolidating American hegemony. America is threatened by the unipolar nature of the world in which it is dominating, but it actually doesn't realize how this whole campaign against Russia, against China, against Iran is very, very counterproductive for the West, because the opposing camp that is actually bearing the brunt of Western hegemony and sanctions is forming stronger alliances. You know, the US is increasing the list of countries that they are opposed to, and these entities are getting stronger, and they will seek to break the hegemony of the dollar through building those parallel systems and those parallel alliances, whether it's the Shanghai Cooperation Council, the Shanghai Cooperation, whether it's BRICS, and this new world order is being formed, including Russia, China, Iran, that are key players. It is a multipolar world and will therefore balance out the American fist. I think by now the hypocrisy is clear for everyone to see, right? And the decision that Russia took has to be seen.
How do you deliver? How do you deliver that message? As you said, the hypocrisy that is evident to see. How do you deliver that message across the world?
I mean, the hypocrisy is clear on every single level. I mean, the biggest form of tyranny is the propaganda machine. You know, if the West truly cares about freedom, for example, those 275 million tweets that we saw about Mahsa Amini would be against Western sanctions that killed thousands of vulnerable women and children. We would see those 275 million tweets, for example, against the dictatorship of Saudi Arabia that doesn't even have elections, and it's only enabled to carry out crimes of the highest order due to the protection that it receives from the West as its client state. We would see record-breaking tweets, for example, for the Muslim women that are forced to unveil in supposed enlightened secular societies like France, indeed, you know, that are supposed to protect religious freedoms, let alone singling out Muslim targets.
So why doesn't that happen, say, Mohsen Abbas, when it comes to Palestinians, for example? Why does the EU, first of all, come out, and it's supposed to be part of the Mideast Quartet, come to think of it, but they only come out and condemn. But why isn't there a massive tweet storm against what Israel is doing against Palestinians?
because all of these social media sites, most of the Western media outlets, whether they're television, social media, Twitter, Facebook, name them all, whichever one you want to turn to, ultimately the hand and the finance and the people that control it in the background are all part of one very powerful neoliberal, neoconservative ideology. And what they've done, what they're doing today is not something that's happened overnight. This is something that they planned at the turn of the century. They said very clearly the American military was going to knock out seven nations. Out of that, they pretty much done it to everybody except Iran and Venezuela. I think they're the only ones left out of that system. So you're faced with a pre-planned, premeditated, absolutely calculated attack by the most powerful forces in this world, and they have an ideological problem with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Let's not forget that. Imam Khomeini set up an establishment here which has some moral values, and it has a dream. It has an Islamic dream, whether it's being able to achieve it, absolutely not. They're certainly not allowing it to achieve that dream in the way that perhaps he would have envisaged. But nonetheless, that war, that ideological war, is real, it's existential. You see, once you have an ideology like neoliberalism, which wants narcissism, which wants hedonism, which wants to promote all of this kind of slavery of a new kind to the world, you have to have a thinking, an ideology, a kind of a dream which opposes that. The Islamic dream that Iran has been given. At the heart of it, Imam Khamenei has fully embraced that,
right.
And I hear it in all of his speeches. He's very smart, big wise, okay. Knows exactly what he's saying, and he is consciously opposing that
sure.
Hedonism, that kind of very, very evil kind of ideology that's coming from these forces.
Okay, final question about Tulsubedi. I told you time is running out quickly, so I give you a minute on this. Is what kind of response should Iran give, which is proportionate and reciprocal when it comes to the EU sanctions, and how do you think that response should be given?
Right. So I think sanctions on entities and individuals in Iran have existed for 40 years. It doesn't affect Iran at this point. Iran has managed to create a resistance economy out of it on every single level, from manufacturing to agriculture to scientific growth. Sanctions have actually backfired. So in a way, when Europe sanctions Iran, Iran turns those problems into opportunities, and it figures out a way that it can actually grow itself out of it. So it's not expected that these sanctions from the Europeans would affect Iran. What I would say is these sanctions are actually affecting relations, because it shows Europe is unreliable. It shows that they don't stick to their pledges. So it's actually harming Europe's reputation and Europe's stance more than it can ever harm Iran.
Thank you so much, Betul Subedi, political analyst. Said Mohsen Abbas, a pleasure, journalist and political commentator, both from London. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kavit Ahwe, it's goodbye until the next Spotlight.